prescient it may be, the opportunity to discuss international matters is always a great topic for us at the firm, given the amount of international work we've done. Years ago, we realized the importance of the interconnection of the U.S. and the things we do here with our foreign neighbors, and know that everybody has a connection with assets overseas. Even this morning, I'm getting an email from a client and a business relationship showing photos of the bank branches in Miami Beach, which I said, how is this an indication of the foreign markets? And he said, all the international people come in July and August, and they open up bank accounts in the U.S., and the bank branches are empty. So we know that a part of this may be the still struggling European economy and even in Asia, but some of it also may be connected with Brexit and some pieces of this we may not have no explanation for. So the next 10 pieces we're putting together were created through Elizabeth in our office, Elizabeth Fortu, who heads our international practice and for years has taken a great interest in both the probate process and also the international taxation issues that we're dealing with. Together with a summer intern, Alex Garcia, who's in from Johns Hopkins and loves this international area well, is in fact hails from Miami. So enjoys these pieces too. So first let's chat about Brexit after the referendum and what we know at present. So as you know, to join the EU, the UK had to revise its own laws to conform to the EU law in order to facilitate the free movement of goods and services and prices across the EU markets. The policy did not have much impact on the UK, on the UK individual domiciled in the UK. However, the regulations governing cross-border transactions for corporate taxpayers will no longer apply. How long it takes to unravel this could take several years. We need to look to the UK treaties with other countries dealing with the double taxation of both non-domiciled UK individuals and corporations, and which may provide some structure. So typically the U.S. has treaties with many of the most developed nations. The idea being that if you owe tax in that country and you're deemed to be a resident, but you are a U.S. citizen or have assets in the U.S., to the extent they generate income, if you are paying tax in that foreign jurisdiction, you'll get a credit against your tax in the U.S. All of these things will now have to be readdressed going forward as England leaves the EU. For individuals, EU membership provides their free movement. Therefore, persons moving in and out of Britain will have to deal with residency issues, passports, including the loss of their right to stay in the UK and live and work. Without getting into that complexity, it just means that if you have, and many of you do have assets in the UK, we have clients that are renovating and purchasing apartments and other commercial real estate in London and outside of London. The key aspect here is to know that that no longer buys you an automatic entrance for weekend jaunts to the rest of Europe. It also may make it more impactful if you were renting because of the interconnection with the rest of the continent and its now disconnection with England. So assets abroad, U.S. clients with non-U.S. assets, U.S. citizens and resident aliens are subject to U.S. income tax on their worldwide assets, as you well know. A non-resident alien is taxed only on its U.S. source income, including income connected with U.S. business or capital gains from the sale of U.S. property. So keeping it simple, if you are either a green card holder, a U.S. citizen, or you are a non-green card holder but are here significantly long enough that the U.S., and on an annual basis, the U.S. then treats you as a resident, you will be subject to taxes and taxation on your income worldwide. If you are a non-resident, non-citizen, meaning that you're just a occasional visitor here and you have assets in the U.S., you will only be subject to U.S. asset sourced income. Very, very important connection here. We have many clients who make sure they don't stay more than the 180 days on U.S. soil and are jumping on planes and so forth back to the country of their origin or at least outside the U.S. so that they're not deemed to be a resident here, which could have a profound impact on their income tax on their worldwide assets. With respect to the estate tax issues, given the increased lifetime exemption, lifetime gifts of foreign assets are an option to reduce the burden of U.S. persons owning non-U.S. assets. So an important connection here as well with respect to taking care of gifting. A non-resident alien planning to immigrate to the U.S. should consider purchasing U.S. real estate through a foreign corporation and making unlimited non-U.S., unlimited non-U.S. situs gifts to U.S. persons, directly or indirectly, prior to immigrating. We recommend, so if we have clients who are non-resident, non-citizens living overseas, and many of you have parents or grandparents who have assets in places like India or all along the European continent or South America, if you're bringing your in-laws or your folks over here and you want to naturalize them, there are great opportunities for them to make multi-generational gifts to you and to your children, but it must remain inside a trust and set that up because there is no gift tax when they're making that gift prior to coming here and you're taking advantage of multi-generational tax exemptions. Key aspect to take advantage of before they come on U.S. soil. Number three, the financial fine print. Compliance beyond FBAR. So it's now many years, and we've talked about this topic at length, and some would say ad nauseum, on the notion that you must report your assets overseas unless it is a real estate and it is non-income generating. So a vacant lot, your home, et cetera, all items that would be exempt from reporting. All other assets, however, must comply. So, for example, residents who have foreign financial accounts that exceed $10,000 at any time during the year, in the aggregate, okay, you must discuss this with us so that we make sure that you're in compliance with FBAR or any of the voluntary disclosure programs, which are more involved. But nonetheless have provided a wonderful window of opportunity for people who have been out of compliance. Many have said, is there more? And the answer is Form 8938, which deals with specified foreign financial assets, and your U.S. income tax return for foreign financial assets more than $50,000 on the last day of the taxable year or $75,000 at any time during the year. For an unmarried individual living in the U.S., or $100,000 on the last day of the taxable year, or $150,000 for a married couple. Form 8938 is taking much more prominence today as we continue to see larger assets and people taking up residence here. Form 3520. And, of course, the numbers is not material for this discussion, but essential to know that these that there is a form, and we can talk about it offline from here, and we'll be providing you with a summary because, frankly, this international work is among the most in-depth area that we can cover in a very, very small period of time today. So Form 3520 says that when you're receiving a gift from overseas, it is essential that while the no tax is due, break that off with commas, the second piece is that you must report it because the U.S. government says, okay, McManus, I know you're receiving a gift of $1 million from a family friend and you're going to keep that off U.S. soil and you're going to invest it and you're never going to pay tax in the U.S. is what we presume. So, yes, you can receive the gift, but you need to tell us, and then going forward, you need to pick up any earnings on that account, whether onshore or offshore, as part of your income tax. If you fail to file that return, that 3520, there is a 25% penalty, and it does not need to be a financial instrument. We've had clients who've had significant matters of personal property, that they too need to be recorded and filed that the gift is made. Form 5471, U.S. persons who are officers or directors or shareholders of a foreign corporation must file this form if they acquire more than 10% of a foreign corporation share. How can this happen? It's not unusual for us to hear from you folks that you've got family members that own a business overseas, or you're opening up a business overseas because you've been doing consulting work stateside. When that happens, Form 5471 needs to be picked up. Again, number's not relevant, but just understand when you have assets in a corporation overseas, more than 10%, the form must be filed because the U.S. government wants to know what you have. Earnings in the past have been able to be deferred, but the U.S. government nonetheless wants to know when it's overseas. A quick, nice, easy topic, number four, is international guardians. So this is the process when the court appoints a third party to care for a minor's well-being, and can be complicated when the third party is a non-U.S. person living abroad. The courts work through a system of jurisdiction and have differing means to establish that jurisdiction over the non-U.S. individual. So, and we saw this and experienced this in the World Trade Center when U.S. During the calamity, there were non-citizens and some instances non-residents who were living stateside and had children and passed away. How do we get those children out of the country? I cannot tell you how many of you who are expats and here maybe for just a short period of time have said more than anything else, you figure out the taxes, just make sure my children get back to my folks or my brother and sister in England or other places across the world. And that's our job. So the client who wishes to appoint non-U.S. individuals as guardians must address this in their last will and testament. And the names of the guardians overseas and temporary guardians, we always recommend naming a temporary guardian in the U.S. to take care of that child while the non-U.S. guardian is coming over here and going through the legitimacy process. The temporary guardians will help to ensure that the children possess current passports and assure their safe transfer to the appointed guardian. Without clear direction in the will, a court may be reluctant to approve such guardians and restrict this U.S. citizen child from exiting the country, even a non-citizen, because they want to know where this child is going. So New York courts will not appoint overseas guardians to serve alone, but will accept co-guardianship structure with a guardian in New York. New Jersey has a process where the international guardians must appear at the U.S. embassy or consulate abroad in order to qualify. So these are steps that we're taking with each of you on this call who have chosen to have your guardians move overseas, or chosen to have your children go back overseas where your guardians reside. Number five, prepare for heirs, foreign succession laws. So in Europe, and this for the overwhelming majority other than the UK, which follows the common law or trust law, the rules are dramatically different, and even there's a question whether or not you can override them in your will. There is a notion of what we call forced heirship. So if you have a property in Italy or Portugal and you pass away, the ordinary course would be a portion would go to your wife and a portion would go to your children. The idea being, back to the French Revolution, some speculate, we want to divide up the big estates and we don't want to allow the oldest child or the spouse to then leave it to the oldest child. We want to divide them up, which will force the sale and the division of these wealthy estates. This is still the case throughout the majority of Europe, and so it is important to both understand this as a key aspect when you are doing your estate planning, that while in the U.S. we can leave it all to the spouse, in fact, we can leave it all to the children, the spouse does have the right to invade and take a portion, but in Europe, other than in the U.K., there is a forced heirship where the assets must go and be divided. So the legal system in the U.S. And in Canada, except for Quebec, and in Australia, UK, New Zealand, and Ireland, is in general an individual can dispose of his or her property to whomever they want through a will or trust. However, as you know, the spouse will have their right to invade that estate. Civil law is all the other major legal systems developed through the Napoleonic Code, and as we said before, through the French Revolution, and that may go all the way back to Roman law, which maintains forced heirship. Sharia law, there is a considerable variety among the Islamic countries as to its application, but in general it shares more of a common law and more in common with civil law than with respect to succession laws, meaning that, again, you have males that are, contrary to the way Europe is, males would inherit those assets. So a lot of our planning with those who adopt the Sharia law is how to work stateside to ensure that at least the daughters and the females are able to participate if that's what mom and dad want. And Sharia law is taking a more and more prominent role in Europe and in the U.S. with respect to certain banks that adopt the rules of Sharia law, which most prominently is that they are looking for ways around charging interest. That interest contradicts the notion of the rules in the Quran as an unfair way to penalize a borrower. So, new succession regulations apply to a single national law of succession to a person's movable and immovable property upon death and applies both to testate and intestate succession and may avoid local forced heirship. So, for example, if we set up a trust in the UK which avoids local forced heirship, we may be able to override what takes place in Italy, for example, if a trust is holding that Italian property. The key aspect of that, however, is that you cannot be deemed to be an Italian resident. We also think that it's critical to put together a will in your foreign jurisdiction because it will allow for a more simplified and smooth probate. For certain, it's more expensive, but imagine your family having to go through the probate process not only in the States but in the country where you have assets. So, again, we encourage you, and we're in frequent contact with lawyers throughout Europe and Asia who are specialists in working with individuals who have both cross-border assets in the U.S., and, for example, and in the country that they're working, and doing wills on both sides, we doing the wills here and they doing the wills in that country. There are advantages because then we can avoid ancillary probate and the wills can be tailored to a particular jurisdiction and can reduce fees and expenses. Of course, the disadvantages are upfront. You have more expenses in connection with legal fees and increased complexity of the estate plan if it's not in a complementary fashion to what the European or Asian or South American jurisdictions want. It is critical to make sure they are thinking. So consider this multiple wills if you have substantial property or investments in privately owned companies in a foreign jurisdiction. Consider multiple wills if there is difficulty in conducting an ancillary probate. Also consider using a foreign will if there are expected disputes with respect to these properties. The foreign country has not adopted the regulations raising issues considering a formal validity of international wills. And so, again, we want to make sure that we're doing a will in those jurisdictions so we're not counting on the U.S.'s will to be accepted, whether it's because they subscribe to the Hague Convention, which would mean that they would allow for an international will. Simple and straightforward. Identify if you have property overseas. Let us help you establish whether or not we think there needs to be a will in that jurisdiction. Number 7, distinct differences around the goal. Civil law versus interpretation of common law trust. So we touched on this in paragraph 6, and it comes back again in a more complete way in topic 7. So while common law recognizes trust and trusts are regularly used, most civil law countries do not recognize trusts. So Japan and South Africa are civil law, and they're isolated examples that do allow trusts by statute. Colombia and Liechtenstein recognize and enforce trusts as part of their domestic law as well. Liechtenstein, as you know, and even Colombia have become classic jurisdictions where people have moved money where they believe these have been areas of safety. Some civil law jurisdictions allow the recognition of a trust if the trust is valid under the law of the jurisdiction of that trust. So while certain civil jurisdictions may permit common law trusts to hold property under their jurisdiction, the trust may be subject to different tax treatment. So in France, trustees are obligated to report the existence of trust annually, and if any trust assets are located in France or if any of the beneficiaries are French residents. They're also subject to taxation upon death of the settlor, or if the assets, settlor meaning the creator, or if the assets are transferred to beneficiaries by the trustees. So we have clients who created trusts, you guys have created trusts, but you have relatives, is the correct term, overseas. And so now we have reporting requirements because they're living, for example, in France. But it's critical, even though France has reporting requirements, having these trusts created are going to avoid what we believe is the most significant tax, which is the tax in the U.S. In Spain, distributions from trusts to residents are treated as being between third parties, and the rates are higher. So whenever we're making gifts to our loved ones overseas in trust, we need to know the jurisdiction and we need to be clear about what the compliance issues are in that jurisdiction. Typically, having the trust and benefiting from the protections of the U.S. and protection from U.S. income and estate tax makes it far more valuable to do the trust even if we have local compliance. Pros and cons of offshore asset protection trusts. So for years, both offshore trusts are used by Europeans, Asians, and South Americans, and the U.S. as well. Today, the U.S. citizens are not using offshore trusts as much because the U.S. is making it extraordinarily difficult from a compliance standpoint. We, too, believe that there are truly powerful jurisdictions in the U.S. As asset protection jurisdictions, and as attorneys, we typically are not part of creating trusts offshore because there's risk that someone in the trustee lineage may decide not to pay the income tax on the trust. That was never the purpose for creating it, but we believe that we do not want the trust or us to be viewed as participating in a structure that was designed or that provided an avenue for people to avoid paying income tax. We want to be compliant, and we want our clients to be as well. These vehicles are less popular due to closer inspection, therefore, with the IRS and because of unreportable taxable income. But, in fact, offshore protection trusts are still viable for anonymity and, in theory, of course, greater protection in the event of a creditor attack. While the U.S. courts have no jurisdiction to seize these assets, it does create further obstacles for creditors. It does not mean that they cannot punish the makers of the trust or the beneficiaries of the trust on U.S. soil for failing to bring those assets into the U.S. so that they can be surrendered and used to settle a judgment. There are instances in the past where certain individuals have moved money offshore. The courts could not compel them to bring it back onshore. They sent them to jail, and then after jail time was over, they moved out of the U.S. and then continue to use those assets. It is not a game that we want to be part of, but you do need to know what has gone on. Foreign LLCs can also protect against creditors. While the client is appointed as the manager of the LLC, the client can appoint a foreign trustee to oversee the assets in times of legal duress. The Hague Convention on Trust has ensured the recognition and protection of trusts and their assets in these certain foreign jurisdictions. Again, the Hague Convention is something we can talk more in detail, but it was an opportunity for our nations around the world to come to some common ground on what aspects of trust and taxation would be acceptable mutually by the group that participated. Although the U.S. has not ratified the convention, the U.S. has only signed it. A U.S. person can still benefit from countries that have adopted it. Important piece, not the first time the U.S. Has participated in the convention and not ratified it, but we're more concerned about whether or not our clients and you all who have assets in these foreign countries are have signed on to and accept the rules of the Hague Convention. But for sure, it's most important to know that any fraudulent conveyance, i.e. moving assets off your balance sheet in an attempt to avoid a creditor or in advance of a bankruptcy or even any kind of lawsuit that could come your way, could render the foreign trust invalid from creditor protection. It is not, again, not the business that we are in. Dollars and cents, number nine. Taxation of foreign trusts. So a trust where the U.S. laws do not have jurisdiction and where the U.S. person is not a trustee makes a trust a foreign trust for U.S. tax purposes. We have worked hard to avoid foreign trusts in the U.S. when we can because of the much more involved complication with respect to income tax. So again, where the U.S. Where a U.S. person is not a trustee, and the trust is a foreign trust for U.S. tax purposes. A foreign trust is treated and taxed as a U.S. person if there is U.S. beneficiaries or if there is a U.S. grantor, and that's what we always try to do. A foreign non-grantor trust where the U.S. beneficiaries are receiving distributable net income, which is subject to income tax, whether the income is distributed or not. So a non-grantor trust, meaning that the trust pays the tax and the U.S. and it has U.S. beneficiaries, whether or not the income is distributed, is subject to income tax. Okay, so this is a very important piece. You're not able to avoid the tax just because the trust is not making a distribution. Undistributed net income, which will suffer throwback rules, which imposes heavy penalties, so, meaning that if the tax wasn't paid and we have to collect from years prior, brace yourself. So it's very, very important that if we have a non-grantor trust, meaning the maker of the trust is not paying the tax, the beneficiaries are, or the trust is, and you're not picking that up, even if there's no distribution, be ready for a big penalty on tax. Foreign trusts can invest in tax-exempt income or manage investments for capital appreciation only to avoid the throwback rule. So if there is no income, just like in the U.S., there's no tax that's due, although the trustee must remain mindful of its obligation to diversify assets. And this may be more complicated than we need to discuss here, but you just need to know that every trust has a duty to be diversified because concentrated positions provide an opportunity for significant risk in that if they go down, you could see a giant evaporation of the assets. Has the trustee breached its fiduciary duty? So it's not just important to say, well, we're in a non-income producing asset. We need to have multiple non-income producing assets in the trust to avoid the DNI or be subject to undistributed net income and the throwback rule. Number 10, planning, land of planning, portability of the Q dot. So we always are telling our clients, and we have a situation now that we've addressed with you all, where there's an individual whose spouse is a non-citizen and they have significant, significant assets in the categories that you all have heard about, and as a non-citizen is subject to the U.S. income tax. Yes, you can use your portability, which is your $5 million exemption up front. If the husband dies, if he's the earner in this hypothetical, could be either way, and it did no planning, number one is we can have the first $5.4 million exempt from tax because the husband is using his portability, his exemption. However, it's not the most efficient way to do things because that exemption is used now, and now those assets continue to grow in the surviving spouse's estate, and all that growth will be subject to tax. If the tax planning is done properly up front, the assets that you leave to the surviving spouse would avoid taxation through the surviving spouse's entire lifetime. So that portability of exemption is called the deceased spouse's unused federal estate tax exemption. This is what you'll need to talk to us about if you have friends who have passed away and they've left a non-citizen resident of significant net worth. We can do great help for them. Your planning overwhelmingly is protected because we've addressed these issues up front. Portability, however, and this notion of portability is only available to U.S. citizens and U.S. residents. So in our instance, the hypothetical, if the husband dies and he's a U.S. citizen and the wife dies and the wife survives and inherits, she, being a non-citizen, would be able to take advantage of this because her husband was a citizen. In order to have the similar tax benefits as a U.S. citizen, non-U.S. citizens or non-U.S. residents should establish a qualified domestic trust, which we've always spoken about. QDOTs must be maintained under the laws and governed by the laws of the particular state or the District of Columbia and must always include a U.S. trustee. And if there's over $2 million, it must be an institution that runs this, because the concern is that if you do a QDOT, and many of you have set these up, and there's more than $2 million, it may provide temptation for your trustee to just take those assets and move them off soil, off U.S. soil. Having an institution would provide greater protection. When you take out assets from this qualified domestic trust to live from the surviving spouse, be mindful that those assets will be subject to estate tax, the pieces that are distributed. The pieces that remain inside the trust will compound without any estate tax at that point, because the U.S. government knows the taxation will occur when the surviving spouse passes away.